Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm in a hotel room in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. I'm going to speak at a conference here tomorrow. I literally just got back from Venezuela, where I did my interview with President Hugo Chavez. I'm very excited to share the interview. I'm very excited to share what happened, putting our documentary together. And so more information about that will be coming up. The interview will be ready to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox in about 10 days. And then also we'll be uploading it to the Pacifica Network, and that will be the first show that we upload to the Pacifica Network. So our guest today is FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley. And Colleen Rowley was very distressed about what happened on 9/11 and about the mishandling of information. And so she wrote a paper to the FBI director, Robert Mueller. Colleen, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, it's an honor to be talking with you.
Well, it's good to have you on, and I'm glad you're on. We need to talk about some very important things. Let's first of all talk about this conference we're both speaking at. Why don't you tell the listeners about the conference? By the time they listen to the show, the conference will already be over, though.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess the conference is on a couple of topics, but somebody sent me a banner today that said they'd like this to kind of describe the conference. The lack of 9/11 truth is the first casualty of war. So, you know, of course, there's the old saying, truth is the first casualty of war. And they're a little take on that, which is that 9/11, of course, and this use of it and exploiting of 9/11 to use to launch the wars.
Right. And I think that one of the goals of the conference also is to finally get together the people in the anti-war movement with the people in the 9/11 truth movement. I think the 9/11 truth movement, if I really want to be honest, was not very credible for a long time. And I know they used to upset me everywhere I went. They were very rude always to me. But it seems like especially momentum for a new investigation, of course, is gaining strength. So we're hoping that we'll be able to bridge the gaps that have existed between the 9/11 truth movement and the anti-war movement.
Exactly. Any movement has a whole spectrum of people. And you can even see this where churches, of course, the Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod of the Lutherans, and people looking at the outside of it would be surprised to find people debating about things that don't seem to even matter that much. I think the real consensus between truth and the unjustified wars, of course, and the truth of 9/11, there is a large degree of similar goals and purposes. Because if you don't have truth, of course, any administration is capable of doing anything.
Well, absolutely. So tell my listeners, just give my listeners a quick refresher on why you ended up on the cover of Time magazine in 2002.
Well, of course, no one knew this until maybe 2.5-3 years after 9/11, but there were a number of the so-called dots that were not connected, and every government agency had many pieces of information, and they actually had sometimes even ongoing initiatives that if they had actually followed through, they might have prevented 9/11 totally or at least greatly reduced it. And after 9/11, none of the people in government or in private entities that had access to this information or that could have done something were really willing to open up and tell the full truth. And I think what you have then is you have these months before my memo. It was 8.5 months. And in that time period, that's when the torture, the initiatives to utilize harsh interrogation tactics, the Orange Alerts, the post 9/11 roundup of immigrants, you had an immediate, in the void of truth, you had this immediate launching of the the what they called it remedies and ways to, you know, solve our terrorism problems that had nothing to do with the mistakes and problems. And ultimately, the Iraq War was one of those things, too. And of course, this is the whole reason why we have to tell the truth about the mistakes. We had a terrorist suspect in Minnesota. And if they had investigated, you know, in a very, very aggressively, they would have found out that he was connected to the terrorist hijackers.
And that was Zacharias Massawi?
Right. He was already in custody on August 16th. And on August 23rd, just 1 week after he was taken into custody, they had enough information that this went all the way up to George Tenet. George Tenet was briefed with a two-slide PowerPoint entitled Fundamentalist Learns to Fly on August 23rd. And of course, this is something that nobody talked about after 9/11. It took the forcing this truth out of these officials.
What was the response to you when you testified at the 9/11 Commission hearings?
Well, people don't know this. The 9/11 Commission did not really listen to anyone in the FBI, other than, I think, Director Mueller and this lady who was trying to start the FBI or improve the FBI's computer system. They were the only people that had any input into the 9/11 Commission. What I testified for, or actually was debriefed in connection with, was this Joint Intelligence Committee inquiry. And then also I was testified to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. But the 9/11 Commission, that Chapter 8, which is entitled The System is Blinking Red, that's all based on the Joint Intelligence Committee, the Inspector General, and the Judiciary Committee's findings. They did no new work of their own at all on that.
What do you think happened? What was the failure
The failure of the 9/11 Commission?
No, the failure of, do you think it was a computer glitch in your case?
In our case, it's a mixture of reasons, and I don't think I'd have really enough time to explain it completely on the phone, so I think that'll have to be something we do at the conference. It's a mixture of things, but a lot of officials who allow endemic problems to go on for years. There was one pretty serious problem called the wall, which prevented sharing of intelligence with criminal investigators. And that had gone on for 10, 12 years, something maybe even longer, and it was a complete mistaken understanding of the law. Now, here's the bigger mistake. Of course, we have this terrible problem that goes on, and it is a factor and why the information wasn't shared before 9/11. Well, after 9/11, because no one tells the truth about the fact that the law was not understood in this wall, no one tells the truth about that, so Bush then begins to warrantlessly monitor. He actually goes around the entire Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So it's a great example of when there's no truth about the mistake, that it even opens the door to a greater mistake.
What do you think, with your expertise and looking, you know, almost 9 years back, what do you actually think happened on 9/11?
Well, I am going to, of course, qualify some of my remarks this weekend because I am not an architect or an engineer, so I really don't have that kind of expertise or background. I can't explain why buildings came down the way they did. But I can explain a couple of things. I can explain the way the bureaucracies and the way some of these long-standing careerist-type mistakes and problems start to occur. I really have a good handle on that. I had a 24-year career in the FBI, and I saw, of course, mistakes develop with informant development and all these kinds of things in the FBI. So I think we did have certainly a mixture, and it's a complicated thing because you, for instance, have the Federal Aviation Administration unwilling to go against the airlines and tell them to harden the cockpit doors. Because why did that happen? Well, because over time, any agency that works closely with the private corporations starts, they get a too cozy a relationship. You know,
right.
we can see that with all of our corporations right now who are kind of pulling the strings on government. You also have your inspector generals inside your agencies not doing their job because they're under the directors of those agencies. So when there are whistleblowers who say, for instance, in the CIA, the torture example is a great one, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. The inspector general is also under the same bosses. So oftentimes they either sweep it under the rug, and I think I can explain that part of the mistakes and the failures. And I don't know much, again, about the failure of Rudy Giuliani's police communications on that day. I don't know much about the architecture or engineering. I hope to explain more about the intelligence side. And I don't think we do know everything right now. I am certainly want a new investigation because I do not think we know of all the pre-existing intelligence that might have been shared with the government.
I'm just going to ask you this question, and I get asked this a lot. Do you think 9/11 was an inside job?
Well, if you mean by inside job that that there was actually a group of federal employees who took orders from somebody, kind of like the Watergate burglary, where you had a whole group of people being ordered or contractors, I would just say I personally have no information. I have never had anything that would cause me to think that. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that it isn't the case. The other thing that I would be very skeptical that it would be a widespread conspiracy in government, because no conspiracy that has more than a few people, even amongst criminals, amongst mafia people, that doesn't last. You know, if it's one guy, one serial killer, that kind of a conspiracy can last because he doesn't tell anyone and he goes from city to city, you know, like Ted Bundy did. That kind of an ongoing criminal activity, or the Unabomber is a good example. 18 years, we had one guy in a Montana cabin. He couldn't be caught. But if you have groups of criminals that are doing something or conspirators, usually the information leaks out. So I'm kind of wary that it would be a large group. But I think what could be, I mean, certainly there could be information, intelligence from, let's say, Pakistani intelligence or the Mossad, things like that, that only went to, if it only went to one discrete place and was not properly shared, I mean, that certainly is a possibility.
Right. Well, let's jump from 9/11, and you know, I was looking at your Wikipedia page, and I'm very pleased to find my name on it, because you did come to Crawford in 2005 when we had Camp Casey out in front of the ranch, and I believe I wasn't there, though, was I?
I think we missed you by 2 or 3 hours. We arrived the afternoon that your mother had fallen ill, and you had just left. And I actually came with another Gold Star mother, Senator Minnesota Senator Becky Lurie, whose son had been killed, Matt Lurie. I think he was a major, and he had been killed just about a year before we came to Crawford.
That's right, and I was gone that weekend because, like you said, my mom had a stroke. But you were actually in the middle of a – no, you weren't. You weren't in the middle of a congressional campaign, were you?
Well, I wasn't exactly in the middle. I had announced I was running for Congress in July. So the month before, I think it was July 7th, it was early July. And so, yes, I had launched my congressional campaign. I don't know how many congressional candidates you had in Crawford. I don't think you had too many politicians down there.
I think we just had a couple.
Yeah.
Politicians come. They didn't want to make it a political event. But did you get any kind of blowback from people for going down to Crawford?
Well, I ended up on the O'Reilly Factor after I came back. I can't quite remember if it was a week or 2 weeks later. And both Becky Lurie and I did conduct some media interviews while we were down there. Becky Lurie, if you didn't know her history, or don't recall it.
No, I know Becky, yeah.
Yeah, she had tried to lead a resolution here in Minnesota, in the Minnesota Senate. And she was only able, this was prior to the Iraq War breaking out, but when they knew it was going to happen, she tried to tell her fellow senators that this would have this terrible impact on Minnesota. And she had a very well-worded, very prescient resolution. Out of 60-some senators, she was only able to get 18 to sign it. And the argument made at the time against signing her resolution was that it would have, that's foreign policy. That's national policy. That won't have any impact on Minnesota. And, of course, all these years later, our Minnesota National Guard is one of the states that has sent troops the most. And I think they served 18 months on one of their stints. And we've, of course, we just recently we had to cut Minnesota health care for the poorest of the poor here in our state because the budget is gone because of all of the spending and the fact that the national funds have dried up. So Becky Loy was completely right on her resolution. And it's just, when you look back and you see all these things that have happened now.
It was very tragic. And didn't Becky run for governor?
Yes, she really did, and she's had a very tragic life. She did run for governor. She ended up like I did with really bad campaign debt. I don't know how much campaign debt she ended up with, but I know she did end up with a campaign debt. And then in a couple of years after that, her husband died unexpectedly. And
oh,
so she's really had a real rough time of it.
Well, let's talk about if you talk to Becky, tell her I said hi, give her my love. But let's talk about your congressional campaign, because I also ran for Congress in 2008. And you ran in 2006. And tell us about your run.
Well, I guess the only good thing you can say about this 18 months of, dipping your foot into the political waters, and the bad thing, of course, is now you're labeled as a politician forever and ever, which I never was. I hate that being called a politician, although if you run for Congress, that's what you are. The good thing about it is, of course, you do get a very good inside look at the way the big money and the way these special interest groups operate and how the electoral system really works. And I had the opportunity to meet with Rahm Emanuel, who was the Democratic Committee, whatever, DCCC, Democratic Committee something or other, but he was the picker or the gatekeeper of all the congressional candidates in 2006. And so
Democrat?
I ran as a Democrat, right. And, of course, I ran against a really right-wing warmonger who was one of the people most enamored of the Iraq War. He supports Guantanamo. He supported Bush on trying to privatize Social Security. On voting record, he's clear. I mean, he's so far over to the right, it's ridiculous. So I'm in one of these districts.
Did you have a primary? Did you run against anybody in the primaries?
I did have a challenge, but it came before the primary. In Minnesota, we have a caucus system for endorsement by your party.
Uh-huh.
And I had, there was a woman who was an established state senator, more of a Democratic Party insider. And she, I found out, had not signed that Becky Loy's resolution. Which really kind of meant that you were either, you were either pro-war or you didn't care about it. It wasn't an issue for you. And I actually made the war the issue when I ran. 2006 kind of became, at least now it isn't the case. I mean, when you talk about the war now, the people in politics will tell you, well, that's not even an issue. Why are you bringing it up? We need to talk about health care and whatever, education and other things. They will immediately shut you down if you try to say that foreign policy and the war are an issue now. But back in 2006, by the end of that election, and I think Crawford was this pivotal moment that really got this tipping point going. And then my campaign, there were certainly some other progressives in the country who really picked up on it and said, this is the big issue. And, of course, in my case, it wasn't hard because I was running against a guy who was this right wing. He was running on, he's a colonel, retired colonel, who had carried the nuclear football for Ronald Reagan and of course, was lamented the fact that we had lost Vietnam and his dignity had been impugned because when he came back from Vietnam, he was not appreciated. And so, I mean, it was almost like a sitcom in the stark difference between this Colonel Klein and myself. And
one thing I learned in my campaign against Pelosi, and you're right, 2006, the anti-war movement put the Democrats back in power into a slim majority, and they've done nothing for us since there. But one thing I learned is the federal electoral system is so rigged to the establishment and to the two parties that it's almost impossible to get into it.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. Rigged, and of course, that was even before the recent Supreme Court case throwing open, completely open the doors to this special interest corporate money. So, it was bad before. In fact, I would say that maybe this latest Supreme Court case, it might actually open people's eyes because it already existed even before this. Now that it's truly opened up, maybe the people of the country will finally say something has to be done.
Well, I hope that happens. I hope people pay attention and to realize that our democracy, surely that was the final hijacking of it. Well, this time has gone super fast, and we just have a few minutes left. I can't believe it. Can you tell my listeners and me what you're doing right now?
Well, I'm going to do an interview on the peace initiatives locally here in the Twin Cities. In about 20 minutes or so, I'm going to be on our local radio here. We have a march in the Twin Cities on March 20th, the same as the one in D.C. And, here locally, they always say, think globally and act locally.
Yeah.
So I've made paper mache avatars, and I may be bringing those out to Washington, D.C. I'll bring you out a photo to show you. But I have a couple of ideas that we need, very creative things that maybe we can use to try to get more people, obviously, to get the people off the couches, because I totally am with you on how people are just way too apathetic right now.
Well, and you have endorsed our initiative, Camp Out Now, on the lawn of the Washington Monument, and we thank you for that, and we hope that you do get a chance to come to Washington, D.C., and I'm looking forward to seeing you and sitting down and really having a long time to talk tomorrow here at the conference.
Sounds great.
Do you have a website?
Yep. I blog at Huffington Post, so if you put in Colleen Rowley at Huffington Post, you'll pull up my blogs. I also am on Facebook, of course, and so I post things there from time to time.
Great. Thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we'll see you soon.
Okay.
That was Colleen Rowley. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and I hope you're looking forward to my interview with President Hugo Chavez. Also, we're going to be moving everything to Washington, D.C. next week to start Camp Out Now on the lawn of the Washington Monument through Peace of the Action. So go to peaceoftheaction.org, P-E-A-C-E of theaction.org, for more information. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, and you for listening.
make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. Sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest, I don't want you to riot, I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, God damn it, my life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.